Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Backcountry in Des Moines, a boutique that believes, as Twain said, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. Located at 2702 Beaver Avenue, Backcountry curates clothing and gear for people who travel in mind now and in person soon.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, Griff the dog, Drake University's live mascot, has many accomplishments to his name. Now he's published a memoir. We will talk about it a little bit later on this hour. But first, jazz was born in New Orleans. It's truly an American art form. Black musicians in the South, influenced by ragtime, blues, and spirituals, created a brand new sound. Today, we'll talk about the history of jazz, how it continues to evolve, its role in civil rights, and its place in our culture. Damani Phillips is director of jazz studies. He's also an associate professor of African American studies at the University of Iowa. He's the author of What Is This Thing Called Soul? Conversations on Black Culture and Jazz Education. He's also a Yamaha performing artist. He performs on the saxophone, and here's a track from his 2015 album Duality. It's called Feel That. That's just a little sample of Feel That. Damani, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Charity. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for being here. And I want to start with a little bit of, the dummy's guide to jazz. Let's do a little abbreviated history of jazz. As I mentioned, it was born in New Orleans. It is a truly American art form. Tell us a little bit about what we know about how it evolved.
Well, you are correct. I think we universally credit New Orleans as being the epicenter of its kind of origins. And I think it's really important that we acknowledge that, yes, jazz is, received as a purely American art form, but we should be a bit more specific in that the ingredients that are together in that gumbo come directly and conclusively from the African-American community. And while the nation has embraced it, it's important that we give full credit where credit is due, and that is a recipe that was put together by African-American men and women. And as you know, it has gone on to become a primary ingredient in music from around the world. It's no longer something that's concentrated in America. We now see it popping up all across the globe, in Asia, in Africa, in South America, in various shapes and forms. So it's not only a monumental achievement of, musical kind of substance musical achievement.
Yeah.
It also is it's also, become a primary, influence on musics from around the world, from the, the treatment of rhythm all the way down to, the way chords move from one to the next. And you hear, jazz stuff happening in Led Zeppelin. Who would think that, those two seem to be two very disparate styles of music, but the potency of that of jazz and the way that music has developed has become a primary influence in many things, and some things more unlike, some styles of music that are a bit more unlikely than others.
So it really launched a musical revolution that is continuing today, is what I'm hearing you say.
Well, it definitely pushed the boundaries of what our ears are accustomed to. And, we have classical music on one side that was definitely pushing in similar ways. But the way that music flows now, even in something as simple as pop music, and the way that people say a singer decides to include a riff in his or her line while they sing, those are things that are direct nods to people like Ella Fitzgerald and Billie Holiday. and blues singers, even before that, if you start to, you know, look at people like Bessie Smith, you hear those influences very clearly in what, you know, somebody is doing in 2020 on their latest pop record.
When jazz music started to be recorded and it started circulating and being performed popularly, it spread like wildfire around the country, and it was very quickly adopted by white artists as well. And of course, at this time, we were in a deeply, deeply segregated nation. We are still in a segregated nation in many ways, but there were race lines that could not be crossed at that point in time. Yet, white artists and black artists did find ways to communicate and collaborate underground. But how did that adoption by white artists and the popularization of jazz by white artists, how did that change the art form?
Well, I mean, when it's all is said and done, you know, the adoption of it spreading to, you know, all corners of society is what, you know, feeds the art form. And, you know, the ideologies and the sensibilities of all different ethnicities has a role in the evolution of the art and it becoming whatever it's intended to become next. So that's a valuable part of it. But at the same time, we also have to acknowledge the fact when it did make that transition that those artists, particularly in the very early stages of the music's development, gave absolutely no acknowledgement to where that music that they were putting out there came from. I mean, our first recording is by an all-white band, the first recording of jazz. And they not only not acknowledged where it came from, but, you know, absolutely denigrated the people that they had gotten it from. Do you understand what I mean? It actually became a thing. We're talking about the original Dixieland Jazz Band. And I won't go into the direct quote that we have on file from the guy, Nick LaRocca, who was the leader of that group. But it suffice it to say, he was very clear in that it was something that he and people that looked like him had created on their own. And of course, we know that if you look at the history very carefully, you know that's absolutely inaccurate.
Right. Straight up theft. As the art form grew, of course, musicians cannot be silenced. How did jazz in some ways really help people cross those racial lines in this country?
Yeah, you know, the thing about jazz that it makes it beautiful is that it's always been kind of an inclusive music. It wasn't intended, you know what I mean, to be, you know, music made by black folks just for black folks. It was, you know, primarily meant as an entertainment art form. And who was being entertained wasn't as big of a deal. So it's inclusion of people. It's an art form that's, like, from its very beginnings intended to bring people together. But the use of the music as a means of speaking out against social injustice or problematic issues in our culture began very subtly. As you know, I mean, and we're talking about in the late 1920s and in the 1930s, where you speaking overtly, especially as an African-American person, you know, was liable to, you know, to bring blowback on you, you know, from being blackballed from the working community in music, all the way down to you being, you know, finding yourself hung from a tree somewhere. So the subtlety in the beginning began very subtly. There was no, you know, speaking out about things in an overt fashion. That came with consequences that may have been a bit much. And so those earlier forces that were using the music that way, people like Duke Ellington and Billie Holiday, did it very subtly and in ways that double entendre. And you get what I'm saying, in metaphor, as opposed to, as we get further into the history of the music, where that speaking out about things grew to be more and more direct with less innuendo and more direct speaking as best one possibly could, particularly with those songs that didn't include lyrics, where there was no direct use of language. It was more of a, you know, a figurative thing like Coltrane's Alabama, where it's just notes. And he's espoused the fact that that is intended to be his personal statement against the, you know, an atrocity that had happened.
over time, even songs with words were used as protest music in the 1960s, for example.
Absolutely, yeah. And don't get me wrong. I think, like I say, I think people figured out that you need to, if you want the music to move the needle, you need to speak to them directly, in direct and non-ambiguous terms. And so even you see in Fables of Phlebas, Mingus, where Mingus is a bass player, and almost the entirety of his recorded work is all instrumental, except for Fables of Phlebas. Now you see the band singing very directly what it is that they're speaking about, even though they're not even vocalists. And of course, vocalists like Nina Simone, where, you know, the veil is thrown away completely. Mississippi Goddamn.
You know, we have a little bit of Nina Simone's Mississippi Goddamn. Let's listen for just a moment.
Mm-hmm. Alabama's gotten me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi Goddamn. Alabama's got me so upset. Lurleen Wallace has made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi Goddamn. Can't you see it?
A little bit of Nina Simone. That was released in 1964. She was very clear about her meaning in that song, which also there was blowback that got her banned from many radio stations. There was censorship.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And at that point in history, you know, there was no, you know, attempting to veil it as it, oh, well, let's, you know, well, let's ban it because it's, you know, it does something other than exactly what she was intending to do with the song. It was, you know, it was clear discrimination, and that decision was clearly made because it spoke about something that folks in power did not want it being spoken about. By the way, you played a live version that's different than the original recording, the first one that came out, where it's her doing a song at Carnegie Hall in front of a live audience. And it's funny, when that song begins, people are laughing at the tune, because as you can tell, there's kind of a, it almost sounds like an old school country tune. You get what I mean?
Yeah.
It has a bit of a or a polka of some type, and people are clapping and laughing and think, you know, and then it
strikes. We're going to have to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Damani Phillips is here with me. As we go to the break, we'll listen to a little bit of Never on Schedule from Damani Phillips' album Duality.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Backcountry in Des Moines, a boutique that believes, as Twain said, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. Located at 2702 Beaver Avenue, Backcountry curates clothing and gear for people who travel in mind now and in person soon.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me right now is Damani Phillips. He is Director of Jazz Studies and Associate Professor of African American Studies at the University of Iowa. He's the author of What Is This Thing Called Soul? Conversations on Black Culture and Jazz Education. He's also a Yamaha performing artist. He performs on the saxophone, and we've been hearing some tracks from his 2015 album, Duality. And just before the break, we were talking about, as the civil rights movement was really heating up in the United States, how jazz musicians were in a position to speak out in some really powerful ways. They took some real risks with their careers and even with their lives, speaking out in some really powerful ways. We were listening to a song by Nina Simone. And of course, you had talked about how in the earlier days of jazz, musicians, black musicians, had to be more covert in the way that they were communicating some of the messages about equality and justice that they were communicating. That became much more overt during the civil rights movement. Can you sum up for me the role that jazz and jazz musicians played during that time?
Well, you know, jazz had been the primary, say, African-American music style of consequence through much of the 40s. And then we start to see rhythm and blues and soul music start to kind of swell up as the dominant voice. And so jazz was just one part of, you know, this greater effort. Soul musicians were doing the exact same thing. R&B musicians were doing the same thing. Funk musicians were doing the exact same thing. Jazz musicians were simply doing their part from their perspective in their end of the music market, attempting to get understanding and comprehension of the severity and the significance of these issues into the ears of as many people as humanly possible. So jazz has really kind of joined at the hip with all these other forms of Black music seeking the exact same goal.
Jazz music, as I mentioned, I mean, it's a truly American art form. Its history is rich and powerful. The music is so wildly varied. And it's, of course, something that many musicians and scholars in the United States and around the world study. I want to talk a little bit about your path into an academic study of jazz. But let's start with your path as a musician. When did you fall in love with this art form?
Well, you know, I began exclusively playing classical saxophone, and I did that all the way from when I was in high school or middle school at the very beginning of playing, all the way up until 1999, and I got a master's degree in classical saxophone, and then by happenstance kind of fell into a situation that let me truly feel for the first time firsthand that kind of connection between the music that happens in a jazz environment and the people who listen to it, and discovered that that was something that I was missing in my classical studies, that kind of connectivity, that immediate electricity that goes along with that style of music.
And what is different? Try to help us understand what the difference is.
You know, the classical side of things is, here's this, you know, this polished, you know, highly rehearsed, put together product that I'm putting forward to you to admire from top to bottom. On the jazz side of it, or the Black music side of it all, it's not so much about its perfection. It's not about it being admired. It's about it's happening in the moment, connected directly to the people in the room. And so there's a cyclical exchange of energy between the performer and the people who are listening. And what the reaction of the people listening influences what comes next. And vice versa, what the musician does next influences the energy in the room or the people who are listening. So there's a kind of cyclical energy that feeds the moment. And that's why the music is never repeated the exact same way twice. It's happening in real time based on the environment that you're in. That kind of closeness of the music to the people who are listening is something that isn't necessarily front and center on the classical side of things. But on the jazz side of it, it absolutely is.
When just a couple of weeks ago, Wynton Marsalis was on a BBC program, the great jazz trumpeter, of course, was on a BBC program where he was talking about his life and his journey in music. And I was really surprised to learn that he was not into jazz as a young man. That was something that came later for him. And I'm curious when you were growing up and coming up in music, I mean, you turned toward classical music. Was there a sense that jazz wasn't worth your time, or was it out of style, out of date? Why maybe did you overlook it?
Well, you know, in the very beginning, I truly loved the music that I was playing. I really, really enjoyed it. And there were no people in my household that were classical musicians. We didn't even listen to that as a family. That was very rarely played in my home. I just came to enjoy it. And oddly enough, I took a lot of blowback from my home community. This is me standing up playing a classical sonata or something is not something that people where I come from are going to be, you know, lined up around the corner to come in here. That's just fact. So it was not a decision made out of, you know, to enhance popularity or because it was something that, you know, was going to raise my, you know, my social status. If anything, it did the exact opposite in my community. But it was what I loved. It's what I enjoyed. And so it wasn't really an overlooking. It was just that was what was speaking to me at the time. And I feel like if you're going to pursue music as a career, you got to be pursuing the music that speaks to you most directly in order for you to have a chance at being very good at it. If you're kind of lukewarm on what you're studying, it makes the path very difficult.
Now, you're obviously very good at what you do as a musician. What made you want to pursue it as an academic field of study? Because that doesn't necessarily go hand in hand.
Yeah. Well, you know, apart from really enjoying the performance of it, I have a legitimate love for teaching. And I knew from a fairly early on that if I wanted to teach the music, that this was what was required. So it wasn't because I just really loved the academic study of jazz music or even classical music for that matter. It was what was necessary for me to do what I felt I wanted and, more importantly, was meant to do. And so that's the path that you have to go through in order to be deemed qualified to do it. And so it made the decision pretty easy. If if I wanted to be put myself in a position where I could do what I felt I loved most for a living, this is going through academia was essentially the only path to do that.
I'm talking with Damani Phillips. He is director of jazz studies and associate professor of African American studies at the University of Iowa. And when you started pursuing jazz in an academic way, I'm curious because we have already established that jazz is an African American art form in this country. And of course, many white musicians love jazz, listen to jazz, play jazz, study jazz. As you were pursuing jazz academically, you found that you were one of very few African American students pursuing this. So what was that like?
Yeah, that was a peculiar discovery. I presumed that it would be packed with, a variety of people in different programs. But the further up the ladder I got, the more I discovered that there were very, very few people of color. I will be really blunt in that it was a difficult path. There is kind of a dissonance that goes along with that dynamic. As you look around and you see very little of yourself, even in the way the music is represented customarily in the academy, you see lots of elements of the African-American side of music that are conveniently pushed aside or downplayed. And it even sometimes works out to be a disadvantage to you to put those elements forward in how you represent the music and how you play. So it was a philosophical dilemma that I had to wrestle with, and figured that there was, that's the culture of the academy is the culture of the academy. And the way I looked at it is the best way to combat that is to deal with it, get through the experience. And then when you set up shop, wherever you're going to set up shop to be a teacher, just make sure that those things are addressed and how you deal with pedagogy on your end. And that seems to be working fairly well, and that once you're inside the system, you can now, reshape it in a way that you feel is more culturally responsible and culturally representative of the full picture of the music, not just the convenient bits that are easy to, that transfer easily from professor to student.
So as director of jazz studies at the University of Iowa, tell me about your students. Are you seeing a more diverse group of students coming to the study of jazz now?
Absolutely. And I've made that a deliberate effort on my end to make sure that we have a variety of students in our program. And my colleagues there who are very great, I've been very supportive and have also been, helping to address that too. But I think it's important that our program looks like America does. As we study a music form that we're very enthusiastic about saying is American, it should look like America does when it comes to demographics. And that enriches our program. You want a variety of perspectives in your room. And you also want to make sure that you are, imparting those foundational principles that are kind of at the core of the music's DNA. Then the student can go on and do what they want with it. But at the very least, you don't push those things aside because they're inconvenient to teach or because they're difficult to teach. It's our job to know those things intimately and share that with our students as best humanly possible. And one of the things I love about working at Iowa is that starting to get the opportunity to do that and directly address these things that I've been complaining about over the years. And it seems to be working fairly well.
Now, as a musician, you are a jazz musician, but you also are integrating hip hop into some of the jazz that you're performing and recording. Hip hop, also an African-American art form in this country. Tell me a little bit about the relationship that you see between jazz and hip hop and why you're pursuing this hybrid.
Yeah, well, I look at most styles of black music as belonging to a kind of a single continuum. And over the years, we have one part of that continuum kind of rising to the top and being the dominant voice within it. Through most of the 40s, 30s, and 20s, 30s, and 40s, it was jazz. Then we get rhythm and blues taking over. And then we get, funk and R&B and soul music taking over in the 60s and 70s. And sure enough, at the tail end of the 70s and into the 80s, hip-hop takes over. So it's all part of a singular tradition. And the reason why I try to incorporate hip-hop in what I was doing in that 2015 album, it was really a kind of by design, in that I think that jazz music has been taken a few missteps, in that the music that we're creating that is considered to be cutting edge is in a lot of ways missing the mark, and that it's going over the heads of people who listen.
It's not accessible.
It's very difficult to decipher what's going on with the music, and people are turning away from it as a result. And so the design of that album was literally to try to get younger audiences, who I deal with in my classrooms all the time, who have written jazz off as old, stodgy people's music and, elitist music, to give the music a fair shake. And so my idea was to pair it with hip hop, which is something that they're listening to on a regular basis, since that's now pretty much the dominant style of music on the planet in terms of popularity and consumption, to pair those two together so that it doesn't feel like that stodgy, inaccessible music anymore.
Let's listen to a little sample of what you've done. This is a hip bop anthem. That gives us a little taste of what you're doing. That's Hip Bop Anthem off your Duality record. And there are other great examples. I wish we had more time to play more music and listen. So I'm curious, with your students then, do you see them responding to maybe this blending of jazz and hip hop in a different way than they are to either bop or straight ahead jazz?
Well, I think that it's weird. It's like a handshake when you meet someone. If the handshake is peculiar, no matter how nice the person is, you're looking at them, you're thinking about what just happened during that handshake. So this introduction ends up becoming a big deal. If the handshake or the introduction to that person is solid, then you can push that out of your mind and deal with this person, at face value, and assess them based on the laurels of what they present to you. Musically speaking, I think that this is working the same way. The handshake is solid because they recognize the way that the hip hop part of it. It doesn't feel so far removed from their day to day listening. And in the midst of it, you're mixing in all these kind of jazz based harmonic concepts that are disguised in this familiarity. You wrap it in a nice warm blanket and people are a bit more receptive to hearing what it has to offer. And I'd say it's actually working fairly well. I use it for my students all the time. I make it a point to include elements of that in all of the black music classes that I teach, so that they can see that, this is not as a foreign of music as you think it is. It's just the way that it's been coming at you, the handshake in essence, its approach has been kind of a clumsy one. And most people just dismiss it as, okay, never mind it. I'll just go deal with somebody who I know is going to be a comfortable interaction. So it seems to be working to me. I'm not trying to be the single savior of jazz. But all I can do is my small part to, at the very least, try to get new listeners who have previously dismissed the music as being over their head to actually give it a fair shake. And people seem to be responding to it fairly well.
Do you feel like jazz for many people is put in the same category now as classical music? Of course, we know that classical is alive and well and evolving, and people are doing innovative things. Also, they're doing that in jazz. But do you feel like a lot of people have compartmentalized it in the same way?
Well, I mean, statistically speaking, in the nation, jazz and classical music are tied for second to last place in terms of consumer. Listener consumption. And they're both tied for second to last place above children's music, the one style of music that the consumer doesn't choose for themselves. So I want you to understand, you get what I mean? So statistically speaking, the answer to your question is yes. And stylistically speaking, historically speaking, jazz is kind of making some of the same missteps that classical music made, as it saw itself take a bit of a decline in popularity, playing music that's, you know, very far removed from the sensibilities of daily listeners.
Yeah. Well, we are out of time. Hopefully you've connected with a few more jazz listeners today. Damani Phillips, thank you so much for talking with me.
No, thank you for including me. I appreciate it.
Damani Phillips is Director of Jazz Studies and Associate Professor of African American Studies at the University of Iowa. He's also the author of What Is This Thing Called Soul? Conversations on Black Culture and Jazz Education. This is from his album, Duality. This is Talk of Iowa.